This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasuthi. The Times Higher Education Rankings 2013 is out, and on the line with me is Phil Beatty, the editor of the Times Higher Education Rankings. This year's rankings has been titled Asia on the Rise, and there's every reason as to why it has been titled so. Philip, welcome to the show and thank you for talking to us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Philip, just to go back a little, the Times Higher Education Rankings was established in 2004, am I correct?
That's right, yes. We've been publishing a global ranking since 2004, but we did radically overhaul the system and produce a new, more detailed analysis starting from 2010. So we've been working with Thomson Reuters as our data provider since 2010.
That's right. You sort of moved to Thomson Reuters in 2009. What was the rationale for that?
Well, we'd watched the rankings growing and growing in significance, and lots of weight being placed on the rankings all over the world. You know, they're being used by governments, by university leaders as strategic tools, as well as by students as a decision-making aid. So as we saw more weight being placed on the rankings, we felt we needed to increase the rigor of the ranking methodology. We needed to improve the data. We needed to make sure the methodology was more appropriately reflecting, you know, the needs that were being placed in ranking.
Okay. What were the disadvantages of the rankings before 2010?
Well, I think the rankings in the early days were relatively crude and simple. We worked with a company called QS, and they've continued with the system that we used to use. But it was very narrow. It was based on only six criteria. It was very heavily focused on the reputation of an institution based on reputation surveys, subjective opinion, and quite simplistic. It didn't really capture the teaching environment in the way we wanted it to. So we needed something more sophisticated and more comprehensive.
Right. So what were some of the changes that you made? I realize that this year's rankings is only based on universities which are 50 years and, you know, of age and below. What was the reason for that?
Well, this under 50 ranking, we call it the Times Higher Education 100 under 50, is a spin-off that complements our main overall world university ranking. And this is really a snapshot, trying to look to the future. It's looking at those universities that have already managed to achieve great things on the world stage in a very short space of time, decades rather than centuries. You know, a lot of the universities at the top of the world rankings are, you know, hundreds of years old. Oxford goes back 800, 900 years, and Harvard goes back a few hundred years. So we wanted to look forward. We wanted to look at the dynamic institutions that are rising up the rankings that are maybe the future stars. So this ranking is very much focused on the future. It's a snapshot in time. It's based on spotting potential and seeing a horizon scanning look at the future.
But you've obviously left out quite a number of universities, as you said, like Oxford and Cambridge. Will there be a separate rankings for those universities, which are 50 years and older?
That's right, yeah. We will be publishing the definitive world ranking, the Times Higher Education World University Rankings, which will list the world's top 400 universities, irrespective of age, irrespective of geography, irrespective of governance and funding. They will be published in October. And actually, we're coming to Singapore to publish the world rankings this year. We're holding a world academic summit in Singapore, which will bring together some of the world leading figures from higher education. And we'll be launching the rankings in Singapore on the 3rd of October this year. So the main rankings are coming soon, but these are very much meant to be a look to the future, a dynamic snapshot of the rising stars. And I think this is one of the reasons why Asia is so exciting, because a lot of the Asian universities doing very well in ranking are much younger, you know, 20, 30, 40 years old, and they haven't had the centuries of building wealth, and they haven't had the centuries of creating alumni networks all over the world. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think this analysis is particularly exciting and dynamic.
Could it also possibly be because there's a lot of money in education in Asia now? I mean, there are a lot of people in Asia who can afford a foreign education, and hence the reason why you felt there was a need to come up with rankings for Asia.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what we see is that in the overall world university ranking, top 400 universities, there are around 80 Asian universities involved. But actually, there are far many more institutions who aspire to being globally competitive, who are doing some really interesting things, who are providing teaching and research that's noteworthy, that's globally competitive, that are recruiting globally for their faculty, for their students. I think it's recognizing the diversity of the system, which is very important to us, and there's a huge demand for more comparative information on more institutions.
Okay, that's interesting, because in my mind I'm thinking the more rankings that are available, it's sort of confusing for a student or even parents who are trying to help make decisions as far as their children are concerned. Which one do you focus on?
Well, I think it's an interesting point, because I think the most use rankings can be is when you really understand what the methodology shows. So I think the world rankings will be the ultimate sort of definitive ranking of record. You know, they are looking at the world's top 400 universities, and we'll be looking at the centuries-old universities and the young universities all in the same, against the same metrics. And that one is, you know, wonderfully comprehensive and rigorous. We use 13 different performance indicators to capture a university in the whole, you know, looking at its teaching, looking at its research, looking at its knowledge transfer, looking at its global outlook. So that is your sort of definitive list of the world's very best. And you can really use that as a guide to the quality and strength of the brand. So if you're a parent or a student and you're wanting to make sure your child or yourself are going to get the best value for money, the best sort of almost a global passport for the future, you know, the certificate on your degree will be something that carries great weight for the rest of your life, I would use the world rankings, the overall rankings. But obviously we have to accept that not every student will get a place at Harvard or Oxford or one of the other great ancient universities of the world. And some students will be looking for a different experience. And I think the thing that's exciting about the 100 under 50 ranking is that it highlights younger, more dynamic institutions that in many ways might be a better choice for the student. A lot of these big research-intensive universities are so focused on producing high-quality research and pushing the boundaries of knowledge in their disciplines that there have been criticisms over the years that they almost forget about the poor student. They don't give the student enough attention. And I think you'll find this group of younger universities, the under 50s, the universities here in our 100 list, our top 100 list, a lot of them are actually very focused on the student experience. They're very concerned to make sure their students are given an education that makes them job ready, that makes them highly employable, that makes their knowledge and skills very relevant to the real world. And a lot of the research carried out in these universities is very focused on real-world applications, you know, lots of science and technology and engineering, lots of work that directly creates new products and exploitable, commercially exciting innovation. So I think it's always a question that the student using a ranking, the parents using a ranking, needs to understand the methodology, know what they're looking at. But I think the more rankings that exist, the better it is for the student consumer to make an informed decision. You can drill down more than just the broad indicators. You can explore what your personal needs are, which country you want to be in. And what's exciting as well, I think, for Asia and East Asia is that there's many rising stars of Asia. You don't have to always go to the UK or to the US or to Europe for a great education now. You can move within Asia. So Malaysian students could have great opportunities in mainland China, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in South Korea. It's a very dynamic situation, and students are increasingly in Asia looking within Asia.
There is still this understanding or this mindset that universities in the West are still very much better. I mean, how would you convince locals that, you know, even regional universities are doing as well? Just looking at the rankings, I mean, how much of it do I believe? What was your sampling criteria like? How did you go about carrying out this survey?
Well, the work that goes behind the rankings is absolutely extraordinary, actually. We look at 50 million individual citations to 6 million research publications. We survey tens of thousands of academics to find out their views on where the best departments are. We collect information from hundreds and hundreds of universities, you know, hundreds of thousands of data points collected on many hundreds of institutions to build the analysis. So it's a an extremely laborious exercise. We use Thomson Reuters as our data provider. They've got teams of people stationed around the world. We've got an editorial team here. So it's a massive undertaking, and it's probably the most comprehensive and the most rigorous ranking exercise in the world.
Mm-hmm. What are you aiming to achieve with these rankings? Is it just to give individuals a gauge, or, you know, how much do I read into it? Because top flight universities do not always give you the best experience, Phil. Students actually, in my mind, must find universities that actually fit them. So when making choices, how much should we look at rankings?
Well, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that if you're an internationally mobile student, rankings are your number one priority. So if you're investing, you know, potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of US dollars into your tuition fees, your flights and accommodation, and your living expenses, you're making a huge life investment. You know, it's more of an investment than buying your first car, or, you know, probably more of an investment than buying your first home. So I think you need to be reassured that the universities that you're going to be studying at will be a recognized brand, an institution that will be renowned throughout the world, that will give you real reassurance that you're going to a prestige institution that will be recognized by employers, that will give you your passport for life. I think that's crucial. There's lots of research that suggests that the reputation, the ranking position of universities are actually, you know, more important than the location, more important than the course content to international students, because that brand is all important. It's so important when you're investing so heavily. But I'd always suggest as well that you should drill down beneath the overall composite scores for rankings and find out what matters to you. What element of the university do you care about most? Is there a particular subject you're focused on? So you can look at our subject rankings. Or if you go on our website, the timeshighereducation.co.uk, you can find the ranking scores disaggregated. You can look at our teaching scores. You can look at the research scores. You can look at the international mix of a university. And I think it's a question of deciding on what matters to you and drilling down. We also have a free iPhone app which allows you to manipulate the indicators and create your own rankings based on your concerns. And I think as a student who's investing, you probably need that deeper insight below the main scores, the overall scores.
Phil, with these rankings, are you not sidestepping universities who are greater down on the list, who may actually be contributing or have greater value to the student? And how would you capture those universities?
Yeah, I think it's important to stress with the Times Higher Education rankings, you know, we are looking at a certain type of university. We're looking at the research-intensive, world-class universities that are competing on a global stage. And we use world standards. We use globally established data definitions. We use citations data around research taking place in world-class research journals. So at this level, we are looking at a certain type of global institution that's making a global contribution, that's competing on a global stage. But it's true to say that doesn't capture, you know, institutions doing other things, universities that make a brilliant local contribution, that provide access to higher education to traditionally excluded groups, that maybe provide skills in a local community to drive a local economy. We're not quite capturing that. And I think it's important to recognize with all rankings, you need to know what you're looking at. And in this case, we're looking at the big global players or the potentially rising stars of the global stage. I think that's important to capture that because these are the universities that produce potentially the future world leaders, the future captain of industries, the future political heavyweights, and they're also the universities that are really driving the knowledge economy with new inventions and new creations. They're, you know, working to cure cancer, working to answer some of the world's most pressing grand challenges. So it's an important ranking of very, very significant global universities. But yeah, we have to be honest and say, you know, if you're not internationally mobile, if you're not looking for a world-class university, but you want to make sure that you're skilled for a local workforce, that you're getting vocational skills on the ground, you know, it's a different kind of ranking. So I think you need to differentiate between rankings of world-class universities and more domestic rankings. And I think you need different indicators to capture the different elements of a university's performance.
We're discussing the Times Higher Education Rankings 2013. When we come back, we will go through the nitty-gritties of their findings. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasodhi, Phil Beatty, editor of the Times Higher Education Rankings, with me. They've just released the Times Higher Education Rankings 2013, top 100 universities under 50 years old, and it's titled Asia on the Rise. We're seeing more and more Asian universities stealing into these rankings every year. Why is that? It's just not now. Even with the usual rankings, you have Asian universities coming into the foray. Is there a reason for this?
Yeah, I think what we're really seeing here is the commitment of Asian nations, and particularly East Asian nations, to driving the knowledge economy and making sure that their future economies are based on knowledge and skills and human resources. You know, we've seen a real commitment in Singapore, in South Korea, in China and Hong Kong, to people investing in ideas, investing in knowledge, investing in people. So they're putting money behind their universities. And I think what we're actually seeing in the West, in particular, in large parts of Europe, in the UK, and in the US as well, we're seeing that the austerity, the financial troubles have meant that the public sector investment in higher education is falling. And the universities in the West that have traditionally dominated, they're suffering from funding cuts. Certainly the ones that rely on state funding and public funding are struggling, whereas research and knowledge and innovation in large parts of East Asia are absolutely booming. And then in other parts of East Asia, there's a commitment to driving up standards. In Malaysia, there's obviously initiatives in place to raise the competitiveness of Malaysian universities. And we're seeing in Southeast Asia as well, there's economic growth, the rising middle classes, the rising hunger and demand for quality higher education for the citizens is driving change and driving improvement.
Mm-hmm. It almost feels like all of this is being fueled by economic gains at the end of the day. Let's face it, Phil, is that what drives even the rankings and the need for rankings?
Yeah, I mean, I think we find our rankings are used in a wide range of contexts. You know, on one level, it is about students wanting to make the right choice, wanting to make an informed choice. Where should I study? Where can I go to get a prestigious world-class education? How do I invest my money, especially for families who are investing in their children's education? Rankings have become crucial in that sense. But we're also now seeing governments using the rankings. You know, we've seen in India and Brazil and Russia, the governments use the Times Higher Education Rankings as a kind of geopolitical indicator. Mm-hmm. It's a measure of economic competitiveness. It's a measure of, you know, how successful a country can be in terms of creating new knowledge. And actually, you know, a lot of economies are moving from a manufacturing economy or looking at their natural resources, and they're looking forward to the future. And it's all about human resources. It's all about people and knowledge. And staying at the top of the game, staying competitive with your universities, both on research and on the teaching side, is crucial to their economic health and their economic future. And that's where the rankings are playing a big role at government level.
Yep, university managers actually make decisions on where they're going to be going based on these rankings. Vice chancellors could lose their jobs. And of course, you have the income from international students. Now, is that something that's making up the major revenue contributor to universities, exposure to international students? Because if you think about people in the West coming to the East to study, in a way, is a lot more, cost efficient for them. I mean, there's a lot of cost savings in terms of currency exchange rates and things like that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's very exciting about rankings is that, you know, on one level, they do perpetuate some of the old hierarchies that, you know, US universities are best and UK universities are very well, and the Asian universities have got distance to catch up. But I also think there's a tremendous democratizing force of rankings, because they show change, they show the rising stars. And one of the things that's so great about this 100 under 50 ranking is that it shows where the future might be. It shows where the power might be shifting to. And it's great because it says to Asian students and Asian universities that they can now compete on a better, a more level playing field with the West. Students in Asia don't all have to go to America or Britain for a great education. They can stay inside Asia. And increasingly now we are hearing about, certainly in Britain, you know, we're now British students are charged £9,000 a year in tuition. A lot of British students are voting with their feet and saying, well, actually, I don't need to stay at home. I can go to Europe. I can go out east and study in the booming and exciting economies of East Asia and get some fantastic experience for my CV and learn a different language. So I think what we're more likely to see in the future is rather than a kind of brain drain from east to west and a problem that Eastern students go to the West for their education and stay in the West and contribute to the economy in the West, I think we may be seeing now much more of a brain circulation, much more of a sense that Asia can attract and retain students, not necessarily nationally, but within the region, and also attract talent from West into East and get the top talent to come over and enjoy a more rich funding environment and enjoy the networking opportunities of studying in the East. And it's very exciting, and I think it's a change that will intensify and the shift will get more significant over time.
Well, that's a globalized world for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Republic of Korea, I'm just coming back to the 100 under 50 rankings. The Republic of Korea is proving to be producing exceptional institutions. I mean, Korea has two, I think, on the top 100.
Yeah,
two of the universities in the top 10, actually, one of which is number one in the world of the second year running. I mean, what should we be expecting from Korea in the coming years?
I think what's interesting about Korea, it only has two universities in the top 200 of this list of universities under 50 years old, mm-hmm. but they're very, very strong. You've got POSTECH, the Pahang University of Science and Technology, is actually in first place in the world. And the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology has moved from fifth to third. So they take number one and number three. So it's a fantastic showing for Korea. I think what that shows really is the strength and depth of the Korean system. So you do have other strong Korean universities. Seoul National University, the traditional Korean universities, are doing quite well as well. But I think what it means is that with incredible focus, incredible commitment to education in that country. I mean, I always get struck as a Brit, as a Westerner, that the commitment and respect for education in Korea is just incredible. It's so refreshing that recognizing the value of a great education is huge there. That means the government is funding its universities very generously. But also with these two particular young institutions that are so dynamic, so exciting in Korea, they've got a real focus. You know, they've focused on their strengths. They've focused on just being more science and technology-driven universities. They've got tremendously powerful work with industry and business, so they're at the heart of innovation. Their students get an experience that's directly relevant to the real world. You know, they're learning in a classroom, but they're also rubbing shoulders with businessmen and industry, and they're seeing new technology being created by the professors. A very exciting environment, very much a hotbed of innovation, but it's backed by very powerful public commitment to education, a willingness to spend and invest in education, but also with some of these institutions' strong private support. Businesses say, I want to invest in these universities because these universities are creating new knowledge. They're coming up with the new ideas that could be the next big thing in the internet, the next big thing in science and technology. So it's a great combination of drawing in business and industry money as well as having a strong commitment from the government as well.
Singapore's Nanyang Technological University is in eighth place worldwide this year in the top 100 under 50. And it makes, of course, one of the three Asian nations to have universities in the top 10, Korea being one, Singapore, and of course Taiwan. We've come to Taiwan in a bit, but how has Singapore fared? I mean, the National University of Singapore usually does very well in the Times Higher Education surveys. Did they not make the cut because they are over 50?
Yeah, that's right. Because this one is very this ranking's quite cruel in a way, because it just literally, if you were founded before 1963, we just exclude you. It's really about looking to the future. It's really about examining the performance of the younger generation, the new breed of university. So, you know, it is only a snapshot. NUS, the National University of Singapore, does very, very well in the world rankings, but because it's older, it doesn't feature in this one. But what's really clear about Singapore is that it's possibly one of the most exciting global centers for innovation and research. So Nanyang, very much like the Korean universities we've spoken about, Nanyang is focused. It was an engineering school. It's had quite a clear, narrow focus on a particular subject field. It's expanding its subject field. But like the Korean, actually probably more than the Koreans, Nanyang Technological University, an incredible commitment to globalization. Very, very high scores for its international outlook. It's collaborating globally. It's drawing in the best researchers from all over the world. It's linking up with the best universities in the world. So it's got a medical school in partnership with Imperial College London. I noticed that NUS is partnering with Yale University. So in Singapore, it's really establishing itself as a global hub of innovation, global hub of research. And again, there's money. They've got lots of money. They're investing strongly in the universities in Singapore. And the Singaporean universities are very good at persuading businesses and persuading the big corporations to fund them, invest in them, work with them. So they'll often do master's programs directly with specific businesses, delivering specific business needs. So it's very exciting and dynamic. But similar story to Korea, actually. Commitment to education, commitment to globalization, focus, and a really strong commitment to working with business and industry.
Phil, I'm still getting this feeling that it's the whole rankings criteria is still very much focused on science faculties. I mean, you don't capture the arts very much. I mean, you talk about research, developments, academicians, always towards the science faculties. Isn't that unfair to a very large extent?
Well, the methodology we employ, it's very sophisticated. So we do treat the different subject disciplines equally. So all of our work is normalized for discipline. So we capture the data and we compare it against the world averages for each field. So when we're looking at arts and humanities research, we'll compare it to the world averages in arts and humanities. When we're capturing social science and business and economics and sociology, we're comparing it against the global averages in those fields. So we actually do treat all the disciplines fairly, and we do have places like the London School of Economics doing very well in the overall main Times Higher Education World University ranking. But I think with this 100 under 50 list, there's a clear sense that actually the small specialist institutions focused on a narrow range of disciplines do very well. And in this case, it does happen to be those universities that have been very focused on science and technology, which is actually much more likely to attract funding from businesses. So if you're renowned for your arts and humanities, you may not get Rolls-Royce giving you millions of pounds to help them develop new products. But if you're a great engineering school or a great science and tech school, you are much more likely to get the big manufacturers, the big engineering companies to put money into you and funding into you. And also you're more likely to attract those students who are very hungry for careers in those fields. They're very work ready or very vocationally oriented. So I think that's what we're seeing in this younger ranking, that the type of institutions that thrive, if they've not had 800 years of teaching philosophy or 800 years of learning about classics, they've had to start from scratch, and they've decided, well, we're not going to start and pretend to be Oxford University, which teaches everything and has ancient classical traditions and still has ceremonies in Latin. They're going to say, well, we're starting from scratch. If you think about it, actually, Nanyang Technological University was founded in 1991. It's very, very young. Hong Kong University of Science and Technology was 91. POSTECH, our world number one on this younger list, was 1986. They've had to make a decision. If we want to compete, if we want to be world class, we want to get there quickly, we need to be focused, We need to be niche, and we need to be highly specialist, and we need to invest our resources in a really clear, focused way. And I think that's why science and technology institutions do very well in this particular ranking of young universities.
Phil, I looked through the list twice, and I didn't see any Malaysian university. Why didn't we make 100 under 50?
Yeah, it's a shame, really, because we have had some struggles with engagement from Malaysia. A lot of Malaysian universities have said they don't feel ready to take part. Their research capacity hasn't been developed. They need, you know, they need maybe 5-6 more years to really develop their research capacity. They've got to, you know, improve there. So they've maybe withheld some of their data. They've asked not to be ranked. But obviously other Malaysian universities are too old. They've got a longer tradition. They've been around more than 50 years. But last year we did have the National University of Malaysia making it into 98th place. But unfortunately, the competition is getting so intense. And, you know, the Australian university is doing well. And as we've said, we've heard about the Taiwanese university is doing well. The Hong Kong university is doing well. Unfortunately, the competition is so tight that the University of National University of Malaysia has just slipped out of the top 100. It was 98th last year and just hasn't quite made it into the list this year.
Okay. That's funny, because if you did make it at 98, then what did we not fulfill?
Well, in some respects, actually, it's not a question of National University of Malaysia getting worse. I think it's often a case that you have to run fast just to stand still. You know, the global competition is so intense now that actually you can pretty much be continuing to do a good job and even improving. But if other universities improve more quickly, if other universities invest more money and hire more hotshot researchers, attract more talent, get more of their research noticed, that can be all it takes for you to start slipping down the rankings. I mean, one of the things that's apparent from the data we have, the National University of Malaysia, I think, does have to work hard on its research. You know, we're talking about the knowledge economy. We're talking about universities contributing to new knowledge and innovation. And Malaysian universities at the moment do fall behind a little bit on making sure that their research has a world impact, making sure their research is contributing to new knowledge, that their research is being properly digested and shared and understood around the world. So that's the main area of weakness for Malaysia. And, you know, you could argue quite rightly that Malaysian universities have been focused on teaching, and that's a legitimate national priority to focus on teaching. But for the purposes of this ranking, it has meant that they're not quite as competitive at the moment. But I think they're very clearly making steps in the right direction.
Phil, why do you think the Times Higher Education Rankings has been taken so seriously by the world? I mean, we've also got other sort of rankings. I mean, you've got the Shanghai Jia Tong, for an example. Why do you think the Times Higher Education Rankings has, you know, people depend on it much more than
Yeah, I think what we've found is that the Times Higher Education Ranking has become the number one. It's the most highly regarded and the most politically sort of important. And I think the reason is that it's the most comprehensive of the rankings. You see that the Shanghai ranking is very well respected, but it's very narrow. It only looks at research. It doesn't look at anything other than research. It's very broad. It just judges universities on whether they've got a Nobel Prize winner on the campus, things like that. But with Times Higher, we listened to the community. We consulted very widely during 2009 to produce a ranking that really delivers on the priorities that governments have, the priorities that university leaders have. So we use these 13 different indicators. They're capturing the whole range of university activities. We have 5 indicators of the teaching environment. We have indicators looking at research. We have indicators looking at the globalization of campuses and the contribution universities are making to knowledge exchange, to the third mission. So we have the most comprehensive system. We have the most balanced system and the most sophisticated system. And actually, the British Universities and Science Minister, David Willetts, has said that our indicators are more closely aligned to actual government priority. So if government wants to make sure they're competitive in the knowledge economy, our indicators really reflect those priorities. If governments and universities are focused on making sure that their students are giving teaching in the best, the richest and most rewarding teaching environment, we have indicators for that. If universities are committing to being truly on a global stage, producing global knowledge and competing for students and academics globally, we have indicators that reflect that. So I think it's because we produced a system that really closely aligns to global priorities of governments and leaders in terms of what they want for their university system. Students see that and they trust that. You know, the student consumer can understand that it, that we meet these very high exacting standards, so they can be reassured they have a real kite mark on the rankings. And of course, we work with Thomson Reuters, which is another highly regarded global brand.
We hope to catch up with you with the World 400 rankings, is that correct? Probably coming out end of the year?
That's right. The 3rd of October, we'll be launching them in Singapore. The World Academic Summit in Singapore, a fantastic global event, bringing together world leaders. And we'll be at Nanyang Technological University launching the World Top 400 definitive list on the 3rd of October 2013.
Okay. Meanwhile, all these rankings are available on your website. Could you just give me the website again?
Yes, it's timeshighereducation.co.uk/world-university-rankings. But we're top of all the Google search charts. So if you put world university rankings into Google, you'll find the Times Higher Education rankings at the top of the list.
It's a pleasure speaking with you, Phil.
It's a real pleasure to talk.
Phil Beatty, editor of the Times Higher Education rankings on the 100 under 50 rankings on the Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.